day before tax day, and invite our guests from Northern Lights to come and present to us. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Ferris, and I'm a senior consultant in government relations for TransCanada GTN. I'm based in Portland, and you saw me in the audience last week. As you may recall, TransCanada had Jeff Rush, who was our general manager and vice president for TransCanada GTN, which is our gas pipeline business, came and gave a presentation to you last week on natural gas supply and marketing. TransCanada is a relatively new constituent and corporate resident of Oregon in that in November it completed its purchase of the gas pipeline that used to know as PG Transmission. But we are much more than just a gas transmission company. As you may recall, Mr. Rush last week discussed, of course, TransCanada's interest also in power generation. And today we are here to give you a short presentation on a project that we think you'll find very interesting and perhaps even exciting, because TransCanada would also like to get into the electric transmission business as well, serving the Pacific Northwest and other points. And so today I'm going to introduce Mike Hogan, who is the Vice President of Northern Lights. Northern Lights is a wholly owned subsidiary of TransCanada, and this is a project that we've been working on for the last 2 or 3 years. And I'm going to let Mike give you a short presentation. We understand you do have a couple of important bills you want to get to, but we'll keep our presentation as brief as possible, but certainly also be open to any kind of questions at any time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mike? Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, thanks for having us here.
Yeah.
Please, as I go through this presentation, feel free to stop me and ask questions at any time. Now I have to get my machine to work properly. Could be fun. Working a few minutes ago. There we go. Our agenda today is to introduce Northern Lights and TransCanada, and also to describe the regional picture in terms of generation, electric power generation resources, transmission limitations, and future needs. To discuss the projects that Northern Lights is contemplating to facilitate these needs, and to discuss the collaborative approach to regional transmission development that we're proposing. TransCanada, of course, as you heard last week, I think, is a large North American gas transmission and power services company with in the order of $17 billion of assets in pipelines and power assets, very strong financial position, and of course includes the, as Scott said, the Canada to Pacific Northwest and California gas connection. This map shows our assets in different parts of North America. I won't go into a lot of detail on this. The circles are power plants in which TransCanada is invested. We have investment in wood-burning facilities, biomass facilities, nuclear, hydro. We've just recently been awarded a contract for a 740-megawatt wind farm in Quebec. We've also just recently announced that we'll be taking 550 megawatts, I think it is, of hydro resources, buying them from U.S. Gen in the northeastern United States. It's a company with a particular focus on energy delivery and power generation.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
What is the generation in the northeast? Where's that coming from?
In northeastern U.S., we have the Ocean States, which is a gas-fired combined cycle plant, and then we also are buying hydroelectric resources from U.S. Gen.
None of it nuclear?
Not there, no. Our nuclear is in Ontario, where we own a piece of the Bruce power plant. We own a 1,500-megawatt portion of that plant. So that plant has a long history of successful power generation in Canada.
Thank you.
Our total power assets today, I think, operating are 4,700 megawatts, but we'll have that up to about 6,000, I think, within a year. So we certainly are growing rapidly in that sense. This diagram is meant to illustrate resources in the region, and it's not a particularly accurate one. It's more to get the high-level point across that if we look in the region, we have wonderful hydroelectric resources, the blue resources on this graph, which have been developed over the years and are largely completely developed. There are some sites where there's still some potential development, and I'll note here that in northern Alberta there's a piece. There's a small circle up in northern Alberta. That's about a 2,000 megawatt site that is waiting to be developed someday. But also, of course, in the region, we have cogeneration, which I'll speak to in more detail in a little while. That's in northern Alberta, cogeneration associated with Alberta's oil sands development. We have, of course, coal in the region, in Alberta, Montana, Wyoming. We have extensive wind resources, and I know that in Washington and Oregon, there are also wind resources, which aren't shown on this map and should have been. But the point is that we have very attractive resources in the region, and the next slide illustrates that over the years we've developed high-capacity paths, particularly for the hydroelectric resources in British Columbia and the Pacific Northwest. And these transmission paths, were developed in association with the Columbia River Treaty. And of course, by and large, they're moving power from north to south to facilitate reliable supply for loads along the west coast. The next graph is a little busy, but what it illustrates is that when you look into the inland region and these other resources, the coal, wind, cogeneration, and some hydro, we have the potential to develop these, but the transmission paths to get them to the market are very constrained. And you've probably heard, of course, Montana has, I think, the largest supply of coal available in the United States for development. It ships about 2,000 megawatts of power across to this region, but that transmission system is pretty much tapped out. Otherwise, from north to south and from east to west, there's very little transmission capacity from this inland region to the west coast. And yet, the load growth is in the west. In Alberta, we have wonderful resources available to be developed, but we just do not have a large load. We don't have a large population base, and we don't have a large load. Our concept then at the 40,000 foot level is to develop transmission paths from north to south and east to west to facilitate reliable long-term supply of energy for growing loads, particularly along the west coast. We believe that there's a way to do this using what we call high voltage DC transmission technology in an efficient way, and this is a technology which is a proven technology. There are already several, I think about five high-voltage DC transmission lines in North America, two of them currently feeding into Southern California. And this is a technology that's very well suited to moving power over long distances and very, very efficiently. The other thing, of course, when we look at this kind of transmission development is to ensure that we have geographic separation of the major paths. And in part, that addresses security concerns as well, and also just weather-related incidents, so that you don't put all of your eggs in one basket from a transmission perspective. If we look at the markets, we've taken, over the last 3 years, quite an extensive look at the Pacific Northwest and Southwest markets. In the Pacific Northwest, the timing of new supply requirements is pretty uncertain, but we're hearing figures in the range of 2012 to 2015 as the time frame by which large-scale supply would be needed into the region. But there's an ongoing debate about, will conservation move that date out? Will increased conservation efforts be sufficient to offset load growth? We're beginning to hear from utilities along the coast that they anticipate need, perhaps earlier than this, for new generation. And so we're watching that very carefully. The local alternative in the region is, of course, combined cycle generation. This is where you use natural gas through a gas turbine, capture the waste heat into a steam turbine process, and you generate at what I would call a medium efficiency level, generating electricity from natural gas. Of course, there are concerns with exposure to volatility of gas prices, and of course, in this region, there is quite a bit of difficulty in siting plants. The not-in-my-backyard syndrome is always it's an issue everywhere. And of course, in this market, as in the Southwest market, low CO2 production is important. The whole issue of greenhouse gases is a key concern for everybody. In the Southwest market, California, Nevada, and Arizona, we have very high load growth. The need is perhaps going to be urgent as early as this summer and growing. recent announcement from California indicated that they would need between 15 and 20,000 megawatts by 2020.
Could you ask on that, which would mean, what, 8 or 10 different producing sites?
Yes, at least, actually,
1,000 or 2,000.
A lot of these, yes, Mr. Chairman, a lot of these sites are actually in the, for combined cycle plants, would probably be in that 1,000 megawatt range, so this could be 15 to 20 sites, for instance, if they're combined cycle. The local alternative as well is combined cycle generation, but particularly in Southern California, there are issues including airshed for NOx and other emissions, ambient temperature and altitude affect the efficiency of these plants. If higher temperatures make it more difficult to generate efficiently. And, of course, water. You have to be able to get access to water, and that's an increasing issue. Gas price exposure as well as a concern, volatility of natural gas prices. In addition to that, in that region, they have a number of inefficient plants that were built 30, 40 years ago along the coast that need to be retired. And, of course, there's a huge attraction to finding renewable and low CO2 generation to replace those plants and to meet new load requirements.
Could I go back just for a moment?
Certainly.
We're talking about CO2 generation. You were talking about plants because of the difficulty of siting here in Oregon or necessarily in California. You're talking about in BC and Alberta.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, what I mean is that when the utilities and the regulators are looking at plants that could be built either locally or remotely, we see an increasing concern and, in fact, measurement of the CO2 and other greenhouse gases that would be emitted by that plant and consideration being taken in evaluating and comparing those plants to one another on a CO2 basis.
Obviously, you'd like to be closest to where the load would be or where the demand would be.
But that's right, Mr. Chairman. Ideally, you would. And if you're going to be some distance away, you need to be able to, the economics have to be attractive enough to warrant the cost of the transmission. And I'll actually give you some numbers that illustrate how some of these remote resources come into play, how they compare relative to local resources.
My concern is that our governor yesterday came out saying he wants to really cut down on carbon dioxide emissions here in the state, which would seem to me that he's saying we don't want any generation plants in this state. And so it would mean you're going to have to build these plants somewhere either in Washington or further north.
Yes, I agree, Mr. Chairman. This is a really big issue here and elsewhere. And I'm pleased to say I think we have a pretty good solution.
Yeah. Continue.
Thank you. Our concept at this point is shown in the slide, illustrates a green line. The green line is what we call our Celilo project, moving energy from northern Alberta down through Alberta, British Columbia, the northwestern part of Idaho, and through Washington State and into northern Oregon. The blue project is what we call our inland project. This moves energy from Canada as well down and picks up additional energy in Montana, Idaho. Some energy could be coming into this from Wyoming, down into the Las Vegas and Los Angeles area. The red line is one of the existing DC, high voltage DC transmission lines that moves energy today from northern Oregon to southern California. And then we show a line that I think looks turquoise here. That line is a possible future line that could tie the middle of this system together, and depending on how the system develops, it may even be an alternative to the Celilo project, or it may be an alternative to some of the blue. It gives you some flexibility, we think. Now, this is all using high voltage DC transmission technology. We expect that this type of a system would be developed in phases over time, and would probably be, the design of this would be inflected over time depending on the needs of the market and routing concerns, et cetera. I'll focus now on the Celilo project because, of course, that brings energy into the Oregon market. This is an option that would bring low-cost, reliable electricity from plants in Alberta to markets in the Pacific Northwest and California. Cogeneration in Fort McMurray, I'll elaborate on that in a minute. In the longer term, we think there's opportunity for new hydro development in the north, northern Canada. There's wind in southern Alberta, and there's also wind resources that are looking to be developed in inland Washington State, for instance, that we could help to facilitate. And the possibility of coal development along the way as well, depending on the interests in the market. What this does is it begins to create a regional backbone, if you will, of transmission. It's like a transmission superhighway that would tie the north and the south all the way from northern Alberta down to California. In Alberta, we show a little black square there, a diamond, that represents a possible terminal in southern Alberta. This could provide needed system reinforcement for the Alberta system as well. And it's an interesting phenomenon that when these lines get built, that over time, you can add terminals along the way and help to alleviate local transmission concerns. In the same way, in northeastern Washington, there's an opportunity to provide a terminal near Spokane. And currently, the BPA transmission system includes some constraints from east to west that if such a terminal were added, we might be able to help alleviate. There's constrained hydroelectric resources, we understand, that are looking to be developed in southern British Columbia, southeastern British Columbia, and this project could, we think, facilitate their delivery to the market as well. In terms of route advantages, we've done quite a bit of work over the last 3 years on this route. It avoids populated areas. It uses existing rights of way, including following the GTN pipeline corridor for a good part of its distance. It uses government-owned lands. It avoids native lands, military bases, parks, and sensitive lands. It helps, as I said earlier, with the geographic separation of major lines. And this particular route has been approved by the Western Utility Group as a priority corridor. It has not been approved by state siting agencies, so I'm not suggesting that we have an approved transmission route, but one of the steps that is taken at the regional level is to look at corridors that would be attractive for energy project development, and this corridor has received that designation. I'll just spend a couple of minutes on Alberta's oil sands to give you a bit of an idea of the opportunity that cogeneration there represents. Northern Alberta is home to the largest oil reserves in the world with 1.7 trillion barrels. Proven recoverable reserves are at 300 billion barrels, which is higher than Saudi Arabia. Those are numbers. That 300 billion number is the number designated by the Alberta Energy and Utilities Board. The oil in this kind of a formation is actually is kind of a very heavy density oil that's packed in a sand and clay formation, so it needs to be extracted either through a mining process or another process that's called SAGD, steam-assisted gravity drainage. Both processes require heat, but in particular the latter, the SAGD process, requires a lot of heat, which they inject in the form of steam into the ground. Well, cogeneration is the simultaneous production of electricity and typically heat in the form of steam. And these sites require huge amounts of steam, which will otherwise be produced just by burning natural gas in boilers. TransCanada already owns one power plant at this site, producing 180 megawatts of very efficient electricity. In total, there's about 1,000 megawatts of cogeneration already developed in this region for the Alberta market. But the Alberta market is heavily overbuilt today with generation, and if we're going to build more, we need to find external markets for this resource. To put it into perspective, the efficiency of the cogeneration plants is in the order of 75% to 85%. The capital costs are quite a bit lower than they are for more conventional power plants, and these sites offer another benefit, we think, and that is the possibility of not burning natural gas in them, but burning a gasified bitumen product. The first plant to do that is currently under construction. And what that does is it gives you the benefit of burning a product which really doesn't have another market, the lower end of the bitumen barrel, and is priced like coal. So it has the benefit of being a very low-cost resource that has a long-term fixed price, but burning it in a cogeneration plant that has very high efficiency. So you get the price stability of coal, but with the high efficiency of a natural gas cogeneration plant. And this is a unique feature in Alberta's oil sands. We estimate that over 3,500 megawatts of power could be built here of cogeneration.
Could we stop you for a moment?
Certainly.
Question.
Just briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the efficiency of the plant. Can you talk then about the whatever transmission loss you suffer from that plant to your market, for example, if your market is Seattle or Portland?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Representative, we currently today, if we try to use the existing alternating current transmission system to move power from Fort McMurray into this region, we lose over 20% of the energy just to get to the Alberta-British Columbia border. Under the D.C. scenario, we could move the energy all the way from Fort McMurray to northern Oregon for, I think it's 11% losses. So it's a real superhighway approach to moving the energy very, very efficiently.
That, of course, begs a follow-up. What are the downsides of D.C.? Is it higher cost, greater safety issues? What are the...
Chairman, Representative, that's exactly it. It's the higher cost. Okay. However, if you can move enough energy, and we're talking here about moving about 2,000 megawatts, then you can get the economies of scale to make that worthwhile. I'll be able to show you some numbers that illustrate that.
One further question. Could you explain the difference between bitumen and coal? Is it liquefied coal? Is it a different form?
Chairman, bitumen is a heavy oil product.
Okay.
It's
tar sand?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Over $60 billion worth of projects have been announced in the oil sands. A number are under development today. Current production from this region has recently exceeded 1 billion barrels per day. That's expected to reach in the order of 2 billion or more barrels per day by 2010. And so this will become North America's largest single source of oil. And as I said earlier, it's a natural fit for cogeneration. This is a comparison of recoverable reserves. Alberta is shown here with 300 billion barrels. This is the number from the Alberta Energy and Utilities Board publications. Saudi Arabia at 250. Iraq, of course, and USSR, and the USA, of course, at in the pink. So in terms of advantages of this technology, we're talking about proven technology and a proven location. There's already 1,000 megawatts already constructed. We're very excited about the further potential of gasification technology to provide the benefits of the combined benefits of the high efficiency but the very, very stable pricing. The what we refer to as a plant gate price, or the output price at the plant, is a function of the fact that the plant operates virtually continuously. We refer to a plant capacity factor of 95% or higher, and that's consistent with our experience in our existing plants. Also in Canada, high-efficiency generation receives accelerated tax credits, which would apply here. And as I said, the high-efficiency, the latest plant that's under construction is designated in that 85 to 90% efficiency rating. The trick here is that you get a higher efficiency than you would with local combined cycle plants. And frankly, you need higher efficiency because you do have to pay for those losses and for the capital cost of the line to deliver it to this market. Of course, the reduced price volatility due to the higher efficiency or heat rate, and also the gasification possibility. Now, this graph and the next one are certainly a little bit busy. What they illustrate is the long-term, year-by-year pricing of output from plants, from in dollars per megawatt hour, from electric power plants that could be built locally. And I'll give you an example. The bright red line is a local power plant using combined cycle technology. These are based on relatively low natural gas prices as well. I think around $4.50 per gigajoule, I think, in this case. At the very bottom of this graph is the Northern Lights technology with syngas. This takes into account the delivery costs and the losses. So it takes into account the cost of the transmission line and the cost of losses on the transmission line. And as you can see from this, it's substantially lower than the red line, the combined cycle option. If we were to fuel our plants with straight natural gas, we're also lower. That's the green line. There are options of bringing in coal from Montana or a coal plant in western Oregon that would bring in shipped coal, would bring in railed coal. We believe, given all the numbers that we've seen so far, that this technology could deliver at a better price than those as well. And what's really nice is it's not only a better price at the very beginning, but it's an increasingly better price into the future, relatively. This is why we're excited about this possibility. The next graph adds on an adder for CO2 production. In other words, it penalizes plants depending on how much carbon dioxide they would emit, both local plants and remote plants. And again, you'll see the Northern Lights. It starts off a little bit higher price. Within a few years, it crosses over. Within, I think, 3 years, crosses over the price of the red curve, which is the local combined cycle plant, and then has a substantially lower price in the long term. So even when you add a penalty for the losses in the line, which represents CO2, additional CO2 emissions, and the CO2 from the plant itself, this technology appears to offer us really, really attractive pricing in the long term for the region. The next graph shows CO2 emissions, comparing cogeneration versus combined cycle in the region versus bringing in coal from Wyoming coal or Montana coal, and gives you an indication of the millions of tons of CO2 per year that could be saved using this approach. HVDC technology has a number of benefits. Lower costs and higher performance have been realized over the last 20 years. Economies of scale. As I said before, you really need to transfer large quantities of power over long distances to make this technology really perform for you, but then it has wonderful benefits. There's also what I call political economies of scale, in that we're talking about shorter towers, a smaller footprint, if you will, and the next couple of diagrams illustrate here. I always have to say that these come from manufacturers of high voltage DC equipment, so I always find them. Well, they're trying to sell something. This illustrates a corridor that with three 500 kV AC transmission lines, and as you can see, it's a pretty big corridor, pretty wide. This would ship probably between 3,000 and 4,500 megawatts of power. The next picture shows a DC line, shorter towers, narrower corridor. This one line could carry at least 3,000 megawatts of power. So it's a wonderful use, wonderful technology in terms of having a smaller footprint. Capital costs of the Celilo project are in the order of $1.2 to $1.4 billion. That is in last year's dollars and excludes interest during construction. So by the time the line would get built, we're looking at an in-service date of about 2011. So we'd probably be up at around the $1.7 or $1.8 billion by the time it's completed. Those costs are, though, included in the economic comparisons that I showed you. And in terms of going forward, well, what do we need? We've done an awful lot of work on this over the last 3 years. We've done engineering studies, tower designs, right-of-way work, technical studies, system planning studies, etc. We've made a lot of progress. We are waiting, really, to see the support from the load-serving entities, the utilities, line up as they see that the need is imminent, and provided that they're looking out far enough, given that this kind of line needs about 6 years lead time, 3 years to get the right-of-way and another 3 years to construct it. We're looking for, of course, assistance from the federal agencies, because there are federal lands involved, and this line would need to be, the tariff on it would need to be FERC-approved, and we'll be needing help with the each of the states involved and the provinces in terms of multi-state permitting and siting. So we're recommending establishment of a joint policy and planning team with the governor's offices of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, at which then we would propose to give them detailed briefings on the project, identify issues, and work together to resolve them, securing the political and commercial support needed to kick the project off. At the June Western Governors meeting, we have proposed to draft a plenary session resolution to WGA staff, and we're hoping that the governor's offices would support the advancement of that resolution. It's a very high-level resolution that promotes getting on with transmission projects in the region. And then what we'd like to do is to have a sidebar agreement among the states and provinces to establish that joint policy and planning team and to begin looking at how to move this kind of a project forward. I want to stress that in doing so, we're not asking to approve the project at any and all costs. It's rather to get the process going so we can see if it really is the right solution for the region. That concludes my comments, Chairman and Representatives. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for a very nice presentation. Questions from the committee? Well, thank you. I just one or two myself. I am very much in favor of seeing us develop the energy that our nation is going to need, especially the western part of the nation. I guess I'm a little confused as to why Canada is moving ahead with hydro and we aren't. You seem to have no problem in northern Alberta getting hydro projects.
Well, Chairman, I wouldn't say it would be easy. However, we have a unique opportunity in northern Alberta that is on this is really a run-of-river development, which has been too far away from major transmission to be developed. Mm-hmm. Back when I was a young transmission planner about 25 years ago, I was involved in studies of that same project, and at the time, DC transmission technology was too expensive. And the losses just to get it into this part of the world were about 20% on the AC system, even with a significant expenditure. So we just couldn't develop it economically. But this is run-of-river, about 2,000 megawatts, and relatively high capacity factor hydro. So we think there's an opportunity there, but our primary focus is on the cogeneration because the hydro will take longer to develop.
Thank you. The other question I had is, we're told that we're in a global airshed, and yet Canada, who has signed on to Kyoto, is burning a lot of gas and creating a lot of CO2. How do you put those two together, that you're burning and keeping the CO2 out of our airshed when it's a global airshed?
Chairman, I think the CO2 is a global airshed issue, so certainly that's an issue to be addressed. But our belief is that by generating at the kind of efficiency that we can, it'll be recognized internationally that we're offsetting what would otherwise be less efficient generation. And so the CO2 performance of these plants is very important to TransCanada.
Thank you. I hope we can work it out. I'm certainly on your side.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Yes, sir. What makes DC transmission so much more efficient?
Chairman,
in a condensed layman's version.
Time seven.
Chairman and Representative, it's a tough one. There are a couple of things that happen. With DC, it's more like a pipeline in that you can decide how much power you want to move down the line. You inject it at one end and you take it out at the other. With AC systems, because electricity goes along the path of least resistance, you may want all the power to go along that given line, but some of it will bleed along other lines along the way. And those lines aren't designed for interstate transmission, and so you get more losses on those. That's part of it. But another piece is that the way that the DC, now this is, then it gets too complicated. The way that the DC waveform works is that uses more of the conductor and hence has less heating effect of the conductor itself. So, but that's taking me back to my electrical engineering days, which is just a little too far. So
I'd be correct in saying heat and resistance are the...
Yes, and the ability to keep it on the path that you want it on and not to be taking other paths. So, and that's also a reason why it's easier to integrate with a larger AC system.
Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I remember in, I think must have been high school, maybe more recently than that, the argument between Edison and some of his contemporaries over whether distributed DC powered systems or large power plant AC power systems were going to be the wave of the future, what, about 100 years ago. And as I recall that course, they basically said DC doesn't travel long distances. So I was interested in seeing that you're using DC lines. I appreciate the explanation because I think it's been conventional wisdom among liberal arts majors, at least, that you only can transmit power long ways over AC lines.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the DC technology, another advantage is that with AC, you actually need to stop and have a substation every couple of hundred miles. If you look at the North American switching maps, typically 250 miles is the longest AC line that's built, and then they have to have a stop. And some of this relates to what we call switching surges and such on the transmission lines. So this technology is just perfect for this type of an application. Interestingly as well, and I didn't say this earlier, I wasn't clear enough about it, what we need to do is to put converter stations to convert from AC to DC and DC to AC. They're $100 million a pop, so they're not cheap. And again, that's another reason why these have to be very large-scale projects to make them work.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Yes. Chairman, my own reading, Representative Barnhart, of the history was that Mr. Edison had the patents on AC, not the DC, and that's why he advocated AC. But I also wanted to let you know, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as you know, the Council of State Governments West will be the host state for that annual conference in September in Portland, and we've been discussing with CSG West, and I think we're going to be invited to come and give an update to you and other Western legislators on the project. So if you don't hear from now and then, we'll give you an update in September.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Chairman.
You coming.
Thank you, Chairman and Representatives.
We're going to open a hearing on House Bill 3030, 3031, 3032, 3033, 3034, and 3035, mainly for informational on today's discussions, and then we will open work sessions at a later point. Because Representative Dingfelder, I believe, and Representative Burley, and possibly several others coming are here, I'm going to ask them to come and maybe make their remarks, and then they'll be free to move on. So, Representative Burley, I guess maybe you're first, if you'd like to come on up. And you're free to speak on any one of the bills or all of the bills. We will be having another informational on these bills. If you'd like to cover the waterfront or just specify one or two bills, that'd be fine. Maybe Representative Dingfelder, you've got your name up at the top of the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder, State Representative, House District 45, Northeast Portland. And first of all, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee members for hearing this bill today. We really appreciate you having this on your schedule, and I hope that it will be interesting testimony you'll be hearing today, and I know you'll be hearing lots of it. So you'll be just as much of an expert as I am, which is not hugely deep, but by the end of this, we have some excellent people testifying today. We are here in support of this entire package of legislation. As you know, there's seven bills in all, to make Oregon a leader in using and producing biofuels. Together, these bills will provide incentives to produce biofuels here in Oregon, to utilize feedstocks, and to develop a steady market for these fuels by setting a renewable fuel standard for gasoline and diesel, increasing state government use, lowering the cost of biodiesel for lightweight and agricultural vehicle operators, and providing funding for school bus fleets for the purchase of biodiesel. Colleagues, the question is not if there's going to be biofuels industry in the United States in the near future. I believe the question is if Oregon is going to take advantage of the opportunity to be a leader in using and producing biofuels and capture the subsequent economic and environmental benefits. And talking about environmental benefits, you probably are aware that no matter where you live in Oregon, we breathe air that's been contaminated at unhealthy levels, mainly by diesel pollution. Diesel has been linked to lung cancer, upper respiratory illness, allergies, asthma attacks, and death from heart and respiratory disorders. And emissions from diesel-fueled engine include more than about 40 different air toxics, which I will spare you from going into detail today, but many of which are carcinogenic and known to cause birth defects and other reproductive problems. So this biofuels legislation will not only be good for the economy, but it will also help mitigate these health risks, and it's also good for the environment and for personal health. Both biodiesel and ethanol are significantly cleaner fuels, and that's only one of the reasons that I'm a supporter of this bill. Basically, I believe biofuels are win-win for our environment and our economy, and I'm very pleased to be a co-sponsor of this very important package of legislation. I'm not going to go into detail in my testimony because you'll be hearing more from other proponents today, but I certainly will be happy to answer any questions, and I can stick around. And I know Senator Nelson wanted to be up here with me, and I'm hoping he'll be coming up soon. Thank you.
Representative Burley, while you're preparing, we'll call Representative Hunt if he'd like to come up as well and follow you.
Sure. Some room for him. Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I also support this package of bills. In fact, I've signed on to the whole package because I think it will help make our state a leader in renewable energy. And I want to emphasize renewable energy because, to me, biofuels is a part of that. There's no doubt in my mind that biofuels technology has matured to the point that it's a matter of when, not if, we're going to take advantage of it here in Oregon. We have already started with other means of renewable energy. For example, in Central Oregon, a public-private group called the Business Alliance for Sustainable Energy was recently formed. Its purpose is to promote the 64 Central Oregon companies working with renewable power or energy efficiency to the 9-county area east of the Cascades. These companies already employ more than 200 people and generate more than $20 million in sales annually. Without tax credits or other assistance, most renewable energy resources are more expensive to develop than traditional resources. But the other reason I support this package is because of biomass. In 2003, Congress passed the Healthy Forest Restoration Act. That law authorized expedited hazardous fuels reduction projects on 20 million acres of public lands. These projects are going to produce a large volume of small diameter wood and woody debris that has to come off these lands, and right now we really don't have a means to utilize that. As the energy prices escalate, there's going to be an enormous potential for affordable woody biomass energy production. Biomass can be used as fuel, for example, renewable diesel and ethanol. It can be used for electricity and heat and other bio-based products such as composites, chemicals, etc. Woody biomass can also be utilized for traditional uses such as furniture, building materials, etc. The Healthy Forest Restoration Act does include a biomass title, but it does little to address the size and scope of how we're going to utilize that material and, frankly, how we're going to get it out of the woods. For these reasons, Congress has taken some action in the past. In 2004, they passed the American Jobs Creation Act, which, among other things, provides a 0.9 cent per kilowatt tax credit for forest products companies that produce power using open-loop biomass conversion plants. That credit applies to facilities that were online before January 1. In fact, they have till January 1, 2006 to go online. And there's efforts right now to try and extend those credits further out. In addition, currently the House Energy Bill in Congress has some additional provisions, one of which is a biomass grant program, which would be $20 per green ton of biomass delivered. And this would be awarded to any person using biomass as a raw material to produce electric energy, sensible heat, transportation fuels, or substitutes for petroleum-based products. This grant is specifically designed to help address the issue of transporting this material, i.e. getting it out of the woods. It's a very expensive proposition. The Energy Bill is also looking at an improved biomass use grant, which would provide grants up to $500,000 for value-added research or value-added projects using biomass. And the reason I point this out, Mr. Chairman, is that the biomass, biofuels, they're all part of renewable energy, and I think that's really what we're trying to get at here. One of the things that I did was ask the Department of Energy to review these six bills, actually seven of them, including the Senate bill, to see whether or not we might need to make some amendments to them to ensure that we're not leaving biomass out of the opportunities that these bills present. And the response I got back was that it's possible we might want to look at House Bill 3032 and 3033 with some possible amendments to make sure that we can extend these same provisions for the biomass capability. I'm going to work with the chief sponsors on this and others and make sure that, you know, we can try to get this in there. I think we're going to be okay with that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, concludes my testimony. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. I'm happy to be here and support this package of bills before you related to biofuels. The really following up on Representative Burley's comments, he talked about it's not a question of if but when. I would also suggest that it's not a question of if but where. And we really have an opportunity to take a leap in this as a state. If you look at the current production of petroleum, it's never going to be an economic driver for our state. You know, it's a benefit to retailers in our state, although even they are increasingly, with gas prices up as they are, increasingly making very narrow profits on this. But that's it. We don't have oil reserves. We don't have oil refineries here. So there is not the kind of stimulus and economic multiplier effect for petroleum. It's never going to be, that's never going to be our benefit. But if you contrast that with the production of biofuels in Oregon, you've got all kinds of potential economic multiplier effects. You've got not only the retailer who will still continue to benefit at the end, but backing up from that, you've got the producer, you've got the farmer, you've got the forester, a whole variety of parts of our economy across the whole state that really stand to benefit economically. As you all know, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are few issues that unite well together economic benefit and environmental benefit. And this package of bills really is one of those occasions. And I really commend Representative Dingfelder and Representative Krupp. It's really too bad that he's not here to have his strong, melodious voice to resonate throughout the room. That's why we need more people. That's why several of us are coming to try and make up for that lack of volume and resonance.
Talk about his hair.
Please. But it really is one of those rare opportunities for us to all come together and to support something that is going to be so great for the economy of our state and really make us really claim an industry for our state with all the economic benefits that brings, and at the same time benefit the environment in a very real way. So thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add, I am only one half of the odd couple, and as you know, Representative Krupp couldn't be here, but I think he will be here next week. But here comes the substitute. But I do want to just add one aspect that I didn't mention. There, you will hear some concerns today about some of these bills, and these are legitimate concerns. I just want to mention that proponents of the bill have been working, and we're having ongoing discussions and dialogues to try to address some of these concerns. So I just want to let you know that as proponents of the bills, we've been trying to be proactive and address some of the concerns that you're going to hear today, and this is going to be an ongoing discussion. But we've engaged the Oregon Department of Agriculture. They're working with us, and we're hopeful hopeful that we can address these concerns, but you will certainly hear about these further today. And just want to let you know that we've been working actively with this group and share some of the concerns that they have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Pleased to have Senator Nelson with us.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please share with us your thoughts.
Okay. My name is David Nelson. I'm state senator from District 29, Northeast Oregon. I have to declare a conflict of interest because I am a farmer, and potentially this bill could add some value to what I'm doing in my life, and so just that you're aware of all that. And I probably can't add much more than what these folks have said, just that I've signed on this bill. And I see some real potential on this. I think the governor is behind the concept anyway. I think Representative Dingfelder is absolutely right. There are issues out there. Actually, I've been following this discussion in the state of Montana. They're having this basically the same discussion, and of course they have a limited number of days, and I think a bill is just coming out of their house, and you know, if anybody would like to see the information there, I'd be more than happy to share that with you and help you with you know, analyzing what's good about this and what are some of the issues you should probably be really looking at. But with that, I'll save some of your time and just let you know that I'm here to, you know, help in any way that I can. And I appreciate the committee work, and you know, that's how we get things done in this process.
Thank you, Senator.
Any questions?
I don't think so. You've presented quite well.
Hey, thank you.
We have other representatives, I believe, coming, but we will proceed, I think. And did we miss? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Westland, of all things. Come join us.
Of all things.
Snuck in on me.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This panel had credibility until now.
I think we'll strike that from the record.
For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27. I would like to further explore Representatives Garrard chastising the question of the panel's credibility. I notice he did not impugn the credibility of the witness. I appreciate that. Is Jackie Dingfelter testifying on behalf of this bill?
Yes. Oh. Extensively.
I'm sure I have, on a serious note, I'm sure I have very little to add to the salient and very articulate testimony that has been given on behalf of this extraordinary bill. It's not often we get the chance to blend, you know, economy and good environmental sense, create jobs. But just in terms of the process in our institution and how this bill has come forward and the good work of Representative Krupp and Dingfelter, I just want to compliment really all of us on how this has come forward, the institution, the viability of the institution. This is the way things are supposed to be done. In addition to the excellent public policy that this achieves, where the environment and the economy intersect, creates jobs, improves our environment, I just can't think of anything better. So I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your leadership as well on this, and the committees, I obviously urge a strong passage by this committee and could not compliment the chief sponsors and those involved any more than I possibly could. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
I might just ask you, the bill at this point is pretty much heavily agricultural. You're in an agricultural part of our state, but also in a forestry part. Could you tell me your thoughts in terms of biomass?
Well,
the cellulose.
Let me answer the biomass question. I favor some variation of the biomass bill that's going around, at least on the Senate side. I believe it's 408. I am concerned about cost to industrial customers, perhaps a compromise in trying to clean our forests, create some good forest management. And I appreciate very much the question, because in our district, I mean, my district, residents live in terror of forest fires. And I will tell you, with no reservations and no uncertainties, that had it not been for just a little dab of managed Weyerhaeuser ground that stood between the National Forest and Black Butte that slowed the Cache Mountain fire down just long enough to get protective services in place. I mean, we still lost two houses, but if it hadn't have been for that little dab of Weyerhaeuser ground, we would have lost all of Black Butte. I mean, what is the cost of that? What is the cost of that in terms of dollars? What is the cost of that in terms of the environment and putting effluent into the air? I mean, it's staggering. So, as that relates to biomass and cost to ultimate consumers, perhaps there are two avenues we could look at. I mean, we don't want to pass on extraordinary cost to either consumers or industrial users. So, I think two solutions could be, one is look to the Energy Trust. I think it's a very legitimate use of the Energy Trust to subsidize cost of production to market rates. And the other may be plugging into the Green Power voluntary program that I know at least PGE offers in terms of the higher cost of production for wind and solar power that consumers voluntarily avail themselves to and allow themselves to pay. So I think there's a couple of options on, you know, a very good solid concept, again, where the economy and the environment, you know, intersect. As it relates also to Central Oregon, in my district, we are working on a concept of educational and entrepreneurial excellence on a piece of property close to town, and it's where we're going to combine K-20 services, educational services, with sustainable, clean, energy renewable industries. We have Idatech, one of the leading fuel cell producers in the world, a company called PV Powered, one of the best converters of direct alternating current, and we're trying to locate those on this educational campus. I think there's, you know, several examples right in my district in Central Oregon, as there are in all of ours, where a key concept for our future and guiding star to help us all operate is where the economy and the environment intersect, where the environment is good business and where the business is good for the environment. It's where we need to go, and this bill is a great example.
Thank you very much. Pleased to have Representative Boquist here with us, too. Why don't you come forward? Oh, was there a question? I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Oh, you're coming forward. A question from Representative Barnhart.
It is just a clarification. I think I understand what you were referring to. The fire near Black Butte, I assume you're referring to the good forest management practices by Weyerhaeuser as contrasted to the federal forest practices.
Correct, sir.
Thank you.
No, I mean, it's the undergrowth, it's the height of the bushes, and, I mean, that thing came roaring down off the Cascades. Hit that just little dab, and it's just a finger, it's just an act of providence that they had a peninsula of private owned ground that ran kind of crescent, you know, moon shaped around the northwest side of Black Butte. Otherwise, I mean, Black Butte would really be black today.
And that properly managed land acted as a firebreak.
Absolutely, and that's where these biomass fuels would come from.
Thank you.
We're going to need your help. And as I remember, there was a fire near Sun River. It just about entered Sun River and cleaned out Sun River several years ago. We're going to need your help in balancing a philosophy that does not want to take biomass out of the woods, seemingly. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your leadership. Thank you, sir.
Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm representing Brian Boquist. I represent the 23rd House District, which is portions of five rural counties. And in a nutshell, I mean, the seed farmers tell me, I guess, we're the largest seed producer in the state. I came here today, and I'm not Colin Powell, so I'm not holding up, you know, some vial of some interesting chemical product. But much like what I'm going to take a different tact on the bills and present kind of a different perspective, but it's much of what Colin Powell brought forward, though I'm not going to argue about his testimony because of the way it turned out. But needless to say, in the real world, I work in the international arena. Primarily, what our company does is we support international oil field development, oil exploration. We're an aviation company. And On occasion, I have been known to be mobilized by His Majesty's Royal Service around here and sent off to some of these strange places. In almost every single case, there's always the issue that comes up about oil. And so what I want to address is really a foreign dependence on oil. And what we're facing here, if you recall, almost 30 years ago we had an oil crisis. And at that time we had a whole host of efforts, even here in the state of Oregon, in which we started looking at alternative fuel methods. And how do we get, you know, better fuel quality? How do we address the issue of dependence, so on and so forth? The fact of the matter is, given the present state of the economy worldwide, the present state of the dollar, probably when we started this discussion, many of the economics that I believe the senator and the good representative behind me talked about, that we're trying to bump this biofuel process up and get it going, a lot of those economics are going to come to fruition here very shortly. The fact of the matter is, if you travel across Europe, if any of you have, the cost for fuel in Europe would in fact make it economical to produce that product here in the United States. What is really an issue here in Oregon is where we are an agricultural-based, forestry-based, natural resource-based industry, is here we are, we have the ideal environment to be on the leading edge of economic development, the leading edge of technology, if we act. Unfortunately, so often we're on the trailing edge, which means we're the last one to go into the recession, and we're the last one to go out of the recession, which is what we kind of see right now. And it is that, for that major reason right there, that I signed on. I'm co-sponsor of many of the bills that you're going to see before an issue. But it's a simple fact that we have a dependency on a foreign product that continues to rise and increase. And we have some of the smartest people in the nation when it comes to environmental issues in this state. We have Portland State University, Oregon State University, leading-edge technology. And so here we have an opportunity to try and jumpstart this across the board to get us on the leading edge and us into the market to do that. I don't think any one of you, doesn't matter what district it is, by late summer, I think it's the British Petroleum Factory production cracker facility in Washington is going to close down for upgrading, and the price of diesel is going to get higher than what it is. The nursery owners in my district and the farmers in my district are already very strapped as we speak today. And I've been told, not by one, by multiple distributors, that the price per gallon per diesel in the valley may rise to $4. And I think that is more than realistic, given what I know of the international oil community, because my corporation works in it every day. And so I would urge you to consider each of these as you go through and consider the future of Oregon. And here's something that we can do better than everybody else, and we can get on the leading edge instead of being on the trailing edge, is what we are economically now. Thank you.
Sure.
Very salient points. Any questions? Thank you all.
Mr. Chair, may I make just one observation? We are all quite concerned about the price of gasoline, certainly diesel as well, today. I mean, rapid rise, dramatic impact on our economy, single moms trying to get to work and daycare. I mean, it's impacting all of our lives in a very negative way. Having said that, I think it's important that we remember that if we run down to our corner gas station, including the tax, gasoline at $2.50 a gallon is still the second cheapest fluid we buy. That's why the economics of this are going to make, and bottled water is more expensive, Mr. Chair.
Right.
You think about that. I mean, they're pumping that stuff out of Saudi Arabia or the North Shore. They've got to find it. They've got to do the EIS. They've got to pipe it, pump it to a port, ship it halfway across the world, refine it, put it in trucks, take it to our local gas station, we tax it, and it's still the second cheapest fluid we buy. And that bottled water you had right there, about four times as expensive. Think about it. This works. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. All right. I want to move ahead because we are we're going to run into a time problem here today on all of the testimony. I want to hear from Chris Hagenbaumer to do kind of an overview, and then I want to move to Larry Dolly and Lisa Middlesdorf so that they can get back there a little way from home. So I do appreciate them coming. Chris?
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm a program director at the Oregon Environmental Council. And yes, I'm here to kind of give talk about the origin of these bills and then an overview of the bills so that others can really address the merits. We are here in support of the suite of House bills as well as SB 736. This package is geared towards launching a sustainable biofuels industry in Oregon so we can reap the economic development benefits, cleaner air, and at the same time basically diversify our fuel supply. I often get people ask, well, you couldn't really replace petroleum with biofuels. That's true, but you can diversify the supply. Biodiesel is a renewable fuel that's produced from oilseed crops or used cooking oils and unwanted animal fats. Ethanol is currently distilled primarily from corn, and in the not-too-distant future, it will be commercially feasible to produce it as well from wood waste, as was mentioned, and agricultural residues. And these are very abundant in Oregon.
Chris, you have the written testimony. Would you like to highlight some of the information, then we'll be able to read this over later?
Sure. I wanted to briefly say that this was based on recommendations of the Oregon Renewable Energy Action Plan, the Oregon Strategy for Greenhouse Gas Reductions, conversations with stakeholders in the preparation of a report for OECDD, and the genesis actually goes back as far as a task force that was convened by Representative Krupp between the 2001 and 2003 sessions. Okay. And a number of different interests, as you know, have gotten together to support this legislation, from agriculturalists to foresters, environmentalists, fuel distributors, fleet managers, biodiesel co-op members, and also, of course, the businesses that plan to produce biodiesel and ethanol. And indeed, we also have a lot of university research taking place here in Oregon around these fuels. So I'm just going to describe briefly what the bills do. The purpose of HB 3030 and SB 736 is basically to provide incentives for biofuels production plants to locate in Oregon. Building these plants is costly. The construction phase can take a very long time. And so the revenues and profitability of those plants are delayed. And any taxation relief, like this property tax relief, will help the business survive, thrive, and then return economic benefit to the state through corporate tax income. Also, we've heard from many of the would-be developers that they face a lot of red tape in getting these facilities going. And so SB 736 helps by expediting the siting process, and you'll hear more about that from Department of Energy later. The purpose of HB 3031 and 3032 is to provide incentives both for the processing of biofuels and for the utilization of Oregon feedstocks. When you produce the feedstocks locally, you then lower the price of the product eventually. And then you can have also the potential for economic stimulus within the state, specifically the agricultural communities. So HB 3031 expands the pollution control tax credit to include eligibility for biofuel processing and production plants, equipment used in biofuel processing or biofuel production, or the equipment that's used to grow the crops that are harvested for biofuel purposes. And to keep the revenue impact neutral, it removes the pollution control tax credit for alternative methods of field sanitation and straw utilization and disposal. HB 3032 establishes a credit against income taxes and corporate excise taxes for the agricultural producers of plant or animal matter that would be used to produce these biofuels. We believe that passage of HB 3031 and 3032 will create incentives for farmers to partner with the biodiesel manufacturers, provide stimulus for rural communities to support this fledgling industry, increase the production of sustainable crops for a future fuel independence, and promote rotational and supplemental crop production. Moving on to HB 3033, it sets a renewable fuel standard for both gasoline and diesel. When we went out and talked to the people who want to produce these biofuels, the number one thing they said is that the key to a successful biofuels industry will be a steady market for these products. There's really no surer way to develop this market pool than to require a minimum biodiesel content in the diesel sold in the state and a minimum ethanol content in the gasoline. This is also known as a renewable fuel standard. It's being pursued in several other states, and indeed Congress has introduced a renewable fuel standard. One other thing I wanted to mention on that bill is that the 2% biodiesel blend that would be required by this bill would also act as a necessary lubricant for ultra-low sulfur diesel, which is being required for all on-road diesel operations by June 2006. When you pull the sulfur out of fuel, you lose some lubrication, and the petroleum companies will need to add a lubricant. We think it really makes sense to add a lubricant that is a renewable, non-toxic lubricant that could be produced here in Oregon instead of a chemically based one that would be produced elsewhere. HB 3034 basically is another way to promote markets for biodiesel by requiring state government use. They would offset 5% of the total biodiesel. I'm sorry, 5% of the total diesel that the state consumes would be offset with biodiesel. And it also reduces the fuel tax on biodiesel purchased for use in lightweight vehicles. And that is to reduce the price differential, basically, so that if you've got a pickup truck or a car that runs on diesel, you'd be inclined to choose biodiesel. And also, it does waive the use fuel tax if a farm vehicle burns 100% biodiesel. It's rare that a farm vehicle is running on road, but it occasionally does. And then the last bill, HB 3035, protects our kids' health here in Oregon, and it also increases the market for biodiesel. It creates a clean school bus grant fund. School buses are some of the dirtiest diesel vehicles on the road because many of them are very old. And there are really great health risks to kids from breathing this diesel exhaust. So this fund would be created to help school districts replace their oldest buses, install pollution control devices, and purchase biodiesel. And it does require a 20% increase in the annual license fee on retail fuel pumps, and that would generate about $350,000 per biennium. The coming biennium, this would be used for biodiesel alone, and then would be opened up for these other important things. So you're going to hear more about the merits of this package, and we hope that you'll move it quickly on to the next committees. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? I guess my only one, Chris, we've been hearing a lot about tax expenditures and tax credits and helping corporations by giving them credits, and now you're coming and asking us for more.
Chair Anderson, the case with, I think it's just, with the first bill, HB 3030, this is one that the property tax exemption is one that a county could opt out of if they desired. And so they would look at the situation on a case-by-case basis and say, we believe in the long run this is going to be economically beneficial or not, and then they can choose whichever one. HB 3032 does create a new tax credit program. Indeed, that I believe that the only way to do that is general fund dollars, and we're basically presenting these ideas as ones to be considered for long-term economic potential for the state. You put a little bit out now, and then in the long term, you get something back for that. The last one is also, it doesn't take money out of the general fund. It does raise a fee on a particular industry that we believe is is an industry that's connected to the problem. The consumption of petroleum fuel is connected to the problem of the diesel school bus emissions.
Okay. Thank you very much. We would like to call Larry Dolly and Lisa Middlesdorf. They'll come forward. Thanks for being patient.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Larry Dolly. I'm Senior Vice President of the Managing Member of Oregon Ethanol, LLC. Oregon Ethanol has been formed to construct, own, and operate an integrated corn processing facility at the Port of Morrow in Boardman. As part of its integrated operations, Oregon Ethanol will produce or have the capability of producing 30 million gallons of ethanol per year as an extender of the nation's and this state's supply of gasoline and providing refiners a source of octane and oxygenate needed for air quality and performance standards. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to appear today to testify in support of House Bill 3030 and 3033. The environmental benefits achieved by blending ethanol into petroleum-based motor fuels have been well documented. Ethanol's use in gasoline favorably impacts emissions in five main air quality areas: fine particulate matter, carbon monoxide, toxics, ozone, and greenhouse gases, those compounds the scientific community attribute to global warming. The benefits that will accrue to Oregon through the production and expanded use of ethanol extends far beyond the environment. The policy we are discussing today will provide needed jobs for Oregonians. Most of these jobs, hundreds during plant construction and hundreds more as permanent positions at the production facilities and in the support industries that serve them, will be in rural Oregon. The capital investment to construct and operate these plants also will be made in rural Oregon. In Oregon Ethanol's case, the project I represent, those jobs and its capital investment, an estimated value of $60 million, will be in Morrow County, a region the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department has labeled the second most distressed area in the state. The biofuels initiative the committee is considering also will enable Oregon to move into the forefront of renewable fuels production and use. We are a nation and world that relies upon fossil fuels for most of our energy needs and essentially all of our motor fuels. The supply of these fossil fuels is finite in nature and will cease to exist at some point in the future. As the population of the world and the world's economies expand, consumption of fossil fuels increase and supplies tighten. The result is higher energy prices for all consumers, and this has been quite evident in just the recent year. The lack of adequate refining capacity in the U.S. to produce motor fuels and home heating oil has only served to exacerbate this situation. It is clear a national energy policy is needed, one focused on increased production, particularly from domestic renewable sources like ethanol, that can help build a sustainable future. Oregon has realized very little benefit from the exploration, development, and processing of fossil fuels. As Congress attempts to formulate a comprehensive energy bill, Oregon has the opportunity to step forward, utilize its natural resources and the entrepreneurship of its citizens, and claim its position, a leading position, in producing the next generation of fuels. HB 3030 transcends environmental stewardship to encompass economic development. It establishes the foundation for Oregon to be a significant producer of its own and the nation's liquid fuels requirement, an opportunity heretofore unavailable to it in a marketplace exclusively dominated by fossil fuels. As a prospective ethanol producer, Oregon Ethanol wants to emphasize its support for and passage of HB 3030. As the committee is aware, HB 3030 provides for the continuation of the five-year 50% property tax exemption for ethanol production facilities and allows biodiesel facilities to also participate in the program. HB 3030 is vital to establishing an ethanol industry in Oregon as it helps create a level playing field with existing facilities in the Midwest. Most of these Midwestern facilities received a property tax exemption similar in nature and value as to that provided in this bill, but the businesses that built and own these facilities have also been the recipient of transportation and utility infrastructure improvements, roads, rail, water, electricity, natural gas delivery, paid by their local government to the battery limits of their properties. They also are the recipients of direct producer payments from their state governments, and in many of these states, those incentive payments have amounted to $2 to $3 million per year and run for a 7 to 10 year period of time. By offsetting a portion of the property taxes to be paid by ethanol production plants in their first few years of operation, House Bill 3030 will permit Oregon ethanol and other biofuel producers to more effectively compete in the marketplace. I'd like to go back to a statement that one of the sponsors brought out this morning and talk a little bit more about, or this afternoon, and talk a little bit more about Oregon ethanol. There are 98 ethanol plants or 97 ethanol plants currently in operation or under construction in the United States today. Oregon ethanol believes it will be the first one with the capability of manufacturing its energy requirements from non-fossil fuel sources. We will draw upon the Healthy Forest Initiative that was discussed earlier, source wood waste, and generate our steam and our electricity from wood waste at our facility. We'll be the first facility in the country able to do that. None of the feedstock, none of the corn that we process through our facility will be wasted. We'll capture all of the protein that's left over from fermentation, the ethanol, the carbon dioxide, so everything that is possible to generate from its operations, Oregon ethanol will collect. Mr. Chairman, Oregon ethanol is committed to working with you and the members of this committee, the House and the Senate, to finalize and pass HB 3030, as this bill stimulates economic development in the state, creating an industry that benefits the environment and addresses consumers' need for reliable domestic and lower cost source of fuel. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Nolan.
Thank you for your testimony. It's very interesting. What's your projected startup date?
We hope to break ground in this fall and begin commercial operations in the fourth quarter of 2006.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Would you like to present on 3033 or...
I think if I could come back to 3033 after Ms. Middlesworth gives testimony, I'd appreciate that.
Please do.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Middlesworth. I'm the Economic Development Director at the Port of Morrow. I'm here to support additional growth in rural Oregon. The port's located on the upper Columbia River in Morrow County, where a region that is rich in irrigated and dry land farming. The port's job base has grown from our agricultural roots into a processing park full of value-added agricultural products. We have food processing of potatoes, onions, and other vegetables. Our region also produces alfalfa, wheat, grains, and other crops. Unfortunately, Morrow County is listed as a distressed county by the state of Oregon. We are consistently seeing double-digit unemployment rates in our region. We need jobs desperately. We are ideally situated for additional growth and diversification of our rural economy. We're in the center of the Pacific Northwest with intermodal transportation opportunities for biofuel production facilities to utilize, including the Columbia River, Interstate Freeway, and Union Pacific Railroad. We know that passage of this biofuels legislation package would increase our opportunities in eastern Oregon and other areas of the state. The package of legislation being forwarded this session provides a variety of incentives to stimulate demand and ensure that demand is met by the Oregon industry utilizing Oregon feedstocks. The Port of Morrow supports this package. The Port of Morrow has been working for several years with companies considering producing biodiesel and ethanol in Oregon. The Port of Morrow is a prime location for these production facilities. The biofuels industry will require crop production, oilseed crushing facilities, and processing plants. A facility built to convert biomass to fuels requires several hundred temporary and permanent jobs for construction, operation, and maintenance, which in turn have a ripple effect on our rural economy. One of the producers looking at our industrial park, Oregon Ethanol, will have a $60 million investment and create 40 full-time family wage jobs. We need this investment. We need these jobs. Please support this biofuels package.
Thank you very much. Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, it's not a question, but if I can expand a little bit on what I think is the significance of the Port of Mile coming forth and testifying in favor of these bills. I'm not sure how many members of the committee, or for that matter, members in the audience, have visited the Port of Mile. This is certainly an example of what type of economic development can take place given the the will to do it. As you drive through Boardman, at least when I first drove through Boardman, it was hard to imagine that there was anything there or that there ever would be anything there. And the industrial complex for, a little town out in the middle of the desert, literally desert. I think it's something significantly less than 9 inches of rain a year. The number of people they employ, the number of businesses that are there. And I know, that we have been involved in this with them since I've been in the legislature, and many of you have been very supportive on many of the things that have taken place there, including the probably one of the more recent big projects of the Tillamook Dairy moving to the part of their operation to the Port of Morrow, and the big dairy farms going in there that you all have been very supportive of. So when they step forward with saying this is something they're supportive of and that they're interested in, it certainly, as far as the economics are concerned, lends credibility to me that there's something real here. And because I have not seen them really step out and drop the ball on this. And I appreciate very much taking a minute to indulge me on
that. Yeah.
Well, no, the Secretary of State took it away from me, Mr. Chairman, sorry. And I've been complaining about that now for, ever since he did it, but it hasn't done me a bit of good.
I guess my only question, Representative, was that you talked about Boardman Port of Morrow being kind of below Pendleton, but I wonder if their football teams are the same.
They fortunately... although I have to say it was a couple of sessions ago, but they were the state 3A girls softball champion here, and still have a very fine program, I understand, even this year. Fortunately for Pendleton, they are in a different league, and
so they won't take offense.
No.
Before you continue, Larry, I would like to just, we're running out of time, and for many of our agencies, for the Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy, Farm Bureau, ODOT, and AOI, and American Lung Association, I'm going to ask if you would be willing to come back on Tuesday. We will continue on Tuesday or Thursday or whatever we need to continue this. Sorry, we've been cut off. I will continue with the testimony here, and then also Jim Gilbert from the Northwoods Nursery, and then we will conclude because we have another committee following us here today. So if you'll continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to talk further and testify in support of HB 3033, the renewable fuel standard for ethanol and biodiesel. HB 3033 does more than set a standard for motor fuel sold in Oregon. It establishes the foundation for a new industry in the state, one that provides capital investment and well-paying jobs in rural communities, one whose economic activity generates new tax revenues for the local and state government, one whose product results in improved air quality, and one whose product lessens the nation's dependence on imported oil. Yet with the myriad of economic, energy, and environmental benefits available from the production and expanded use of ethanol, There are those who stand opposed to the implementation of policy to stimulate the production of renewable fuels. We've seen many editorials and newspapers here in Oregon as well as throughout the country in this particular area. There are those that will have you believe that it takes more energy to manufacture ethanol than it yields, and this is just not true. Opponents to the ethanol industry cite the results of a study that used 1992 data for corn inputs and yields, data from the late 1980s for the amount of energy used in manufacturing ethanol, and no credit for the byproduct of the ethanol process as the basis for their position. Today's farmers and ethanol production facilities are using the latest and most energy-efficient technologies available. According to a recent analysis completed by the USDA, ethanol now yields 167% of the fossil energy used to grow, harvest, transport, and refine grain into ethanol. Similar studies by the U.S. Department of Energy, Agriculture Canada, and Michigan State University confirm the positive energy balance of ethanol production. Opponents to renewable fuels also want you to believe that ethanol's use does more harm than benefit to air quality. This also is not true. Ethanol currently is the only compound that may be blended with gasoline to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or what the scientific community has come to call global warming. Let me repeat that. Ethanol is currently the only compound that may be blended with gasoline to help reduce global warming. According to Argonne National Laboratory, one of the Department of Energy's national laboratories, the use of ethanol in gasoline in 2004 reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 7 million tons, the equivalent of taking 1 million cars off the nation's road. Yet there's no program, no computer model that EPA and various State Department of Environmental Qualities use that currently examines air emissions and air quality that offers any credit to ethanol for its reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. Particulates are known to cause respiratory and other health-related problems. Fine particulates can be emitted directly from vehicles or formed from automobile exhaust through secondary reactions in the atmosphere. Ethanol can help on both of these fronts. When oxygen is added to motor fuels, such as when ethanol is blended with gasoline, automobile exhaust particulates have been shown to be reduced by 30%. Conversely, when aromatics are added to motor fuels, what refiners use to increase octane, exhaust particulates increase. And when fine particulates that form in the atmosphere, one notable study showed that the organic fraction of such particulates could be completely accounted for by the aromatic content of gasoline. These aromatics are the toxic compounds that are added to gasoline. Data from an EPA study shows that benzene emissions, the most significant toxic compound, can be reduced by 25% through the use of ethanol-blended gasoline. Those that oppose expanded use of ethanol gasoline on environmental grounds also want you to believe that it does little to abate the formation of ozone or smog. They say that the higher evaporative emissions of ethanol compound the problem of ozone formation. Ethanol's vapor pressure is greater than that of gasoline, but the previous statement by itself gives no credit to ethanol for the significant reduction its use provides in carbon monoxide emissions. The National Academy has shown carbon monoxide to be a major ozone precursor. Studies have shown carbon monoxide's contribution to ozone formation can be equivalent to 50% of that of volatile hydrocarbons. Therefore, reducing carbon monoxide emissions, which ethanol blends do quite well and have successfully done in such urban areas as Chicago, Los Angeles, Seattle, and Portland, will result in less ozone formation. Now, older vehicles account for a higher percentage of emissions than new vehicles. As these older vehicles are replaced with ones that possess improved emission controls, the argument is being made by some, including the Oregon DEQ and the California Air Resources Board, that programs like the Winter Oxygenate Fuels Program and the Reformulated Gasoline Program are no longer necessary. It is unfortunate that this argument fails to take into account the data that shows new cars, when operating on ethanol-blended gasoline, still reducing carbon monoxide emissions and the impact of further reductions in carbon monoxide has on ozone formation. Those who write in newspaper editorials and speak in public forums that renewable fuels should be able to compete in the marketplace without incentives fail to grasp what the ethanol industry has delivered to the economy. Last year, the ethanol industry contributed more than $25 billion to the nation's gross economic output The ethanol industry is now responsible for over 147,000 jobs across all sectors of the economy. Approximately $4.4 billion went directly to consumers this past year through increased economic activity and new jobs. And finally, federal and state governments collected almost $2.5 billion in needed tax revenues from the ethanol industry. The economic benefit provided by the ethanol industry during 2004, as it has done for each year of its existence, far exceeded the monetary value of the tax exemption provided by the federal government for the sale and use of ethanol-blended gasoline. The cost of renewable fuels is often compared to the retail price consumers pay for gasoline at the pump. However, the retail price is not the true price of gasoline. The $2.33 to $2.35 that you can see out on Market Street as you pull into Salem is certainly not a reflection of what the true price of gasoline is. The retail price does not take into account the military, environmental, health, and social cost of the product. Both the International Center for Technology Assessment and the National Defense Council perform studies to identify and quantify the cost that is not reflected in the retail price Americans pay for gasoline. Both studies were done several years ago when gasoline crude oil prices were much less than they are today, but they reached the same conclusion that the true cost of gasoline to Americans exceeds $5 per gallon. Renewable fuels are very competitive when the real cost to you and I are considered. Before my closing remarks, I want to point out that the ethanol industry has developed a strong record working with the petroleum industry to meet the needs of the marketplace, doing so without increasing the fuel cost to the consumer. This was evident in New York, Connecticut, and California when those states banned the use of MTBE, and will be the case in Oregon upon passage and implementation of House Bill 3033. One can go into Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and pull up to the pumps in those respective states. Consumers have a choice of buying an ethanol-blended gasoline or a straight-grade gasoline, and the ethanol-blended gasoline is always several cents less per gallon. As a matter of fact, the CEO of one of the nation's major refiners and marketers of petroleum products said last year that without ethanol, U.S. motors would be paying even higher prices for gasoline. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, three companies, Oregon Ethanol, Cascade Grain Products, and Treasure Valley Renewable Resources, have developed ethanol projects and intend to construct production facilities in Oregon. Cumulatively, these three projects represent a potential investment exceeding $250 million. Hundreds of jobs will be generated for Oregon welders, pipe fitters, millwrights, plumbers, and electricians during their construction. Hundreds more of permanent jobs will be created as these plants emerge from construction and enter into commercial operation. And these three plants will collectively have the ability to manufacture all of the ethanol Oregon requires to blend 10% ethanol into its gasoline supply. Domestic renewable sources of energy like ethanol will, without doubt, be part of building a sustainable energy future for our country. Oregon has the unique opportunity through HB 3030 and 3033 and the entire biofuels legislative package to position itself to produce a significant portion of that sustainable energy and to do so while being a steward of the environment. I urge this committee and the Oregon House and Senate to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. I'm going to hold questions at this point. We are really under pressure now. And call Jim Gilbert to come.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a great pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with you, share my experiences with using biofuels. It wasn't long ago that the word biodiesel would leave a blank stare on people's faces when I would talk to them about it. I was inspired about 2 years ago by my son, who lives in Seattle and was a member of a biodiesel cooperative, as it was called, which would a bunch of dedicated individuals that would go out and get used oil, fat from deep frying machines at restaurants and process it into diesel and use it in their old Mercedes-Benz station wagons and Volkswagens and different cars that they had that were diesel powered. And so through his inspiration, I realized that I didn't have to do that. I could actually buy diesel directly from a distributor. They would bring it out and put it in my tank, 300 gallons at a time or more, and I began using it in my tractors. We have, my name is Jim Gilbert, by the way, and I own and operate Northwoods Nursery between Mullala and Canby. I have two large tractors, three smaller tractors, a skid steer loader, and a diesel-powered van, and all of them I power with biodiesel. Right now I use a 20% blend called B20. I have also used B100, and of course there are some concerns I have when I got into the winter, the B100 fuel wasn't so suitable for me, so I switched to B20. The reasons that I did this were several, and one, I've had a long-term concern about our dependence upon foreign sources of oil and energy. As the previous person mentioned, the real cost of fuel that we use in our country is not reflected in the price we pay at the pump. And the idea of having a renewable source of energy that you could grow right here in Oregon or in the United States was very exciting to me. There's also a great deal less air pollution with biodiesel. One of the interesting things, if you are ever around a piece of machinery running it, especially with B100, it smells kind of like a hot frying pan, and you can go up and put your hand next to the exhaust and pull it away, and it doesn't have any kind of toxic sense to it at all. So it's a very different kind of fuel, as you can imagine. Also, if you spill biodiesel on the ground, it doesn't create a toxic situation. It biodegrades, which is quite different, of course, from petrol diesel. A very strong reason also I did this would be because of my employees. Biodiesel is much safer to work with. If you have a mechanic working on a diesel tractor and spills fuel on himself, biodiesel is just going to be washed off with no problem. But if any of you have diesel vehicles or have filled your tank at a diesel station, you know how hard it is to get the smell off your hands and all the material that's there. So it's a much safer fuel to be around, both for breathing it and for skin contact. And another really inspiring reason for me to support biodiesel was being a farmer myself and really believing strongly in Oregon's agricultural economy and wanting to strengthen it. Biodiesel seemed like just a total win-win situation where farmers could grow a fuel crop, fuel their own tractors with it, as well, and make money at the same time. Which of course is also helping all of our economy, because our state is agriculture is a very important part of our state's economy. So there was just a total win-win situation with biodiesel, and I expect to continue using it for as long as I'm farming. I thought I'd like to share with you, I did a little bit of research before I came down and wanted to share with you some of the differences in cost that exist right now. You can buy at several different card lock stations and a couple of retail pumps, you can buy biodiesel, usually B20. Also, an interesting aside was that when I was in Germany a couple of years ago, I noticed that many stations offered biodiesel. It was much more common there. And also in Europe and in Japan, many more vehicles use diesel engines than they do here. So it's much, right now if you want to buy a new diesel-powered vehicle, you basically have to buy a Volkswagen. There's no other imported vehicles that are imported with diesels in small cars. But the difference right now for off-road diesel, I pay 31 cents more a gallon for B20 than I do than I would if I was buying petrol diesel. And if I were buying B100, it would cost me 63 cents more a gallon, existing prices. And that's, of course, part of that's because of the increase in diesel price, which has been rather severe recently. So it certainly became much more competitive and much more reasonable to consider biofuels. I also want to just also encourage you, and I'm very pleased that you're considering this legislation. Your support is very necessary for this. As you probably can imagine, there needs to be incentives for people to produce and use biofuel. If the price was exactly even, we wouldn't have a problem. But as we've mentioned, there are other reasons why biofuel makes a lot of sense. There is need for research on it. I'd love to see our Oregon State do some research that would help me as a farmer understand better how to use the fuel, and especially under different weather conditions. And also, I think by our state encouraging the use of biofuels, there will be more access to diesel-powered vehicles that can use it as well. So I thank you very much for your time. And
thank you. Appreciate you coming and testifying.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee at all?
Yes, Representative Bernhard, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly. Why was D100 a problem for you in the wintertime?
I had smoke problems with my machinery. I think that when it gets colder, biodiesel hence tends to congeal at a higher temperature than petrol diesel. So it's a thicker
viscosity
oil.
Issue.
Viscosity,
yeah.
Was a problem.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you all, and we'll convene again on Tuesday to complete some of the testimony on biodiesels. Thank you. With that, we're close the hearing on 3030, 3031, 3032, 3033, 3034, and 3035. And I'll close the committee on environment.
Those are yours, I think.